On most summers, Seacoast Church does a teaching series called At the Movies, in which recent movie releases are dissected a little, and the teaching pastor on that particular Sunday highlights some helpful applications, mixing in some scripture while showing some movie clips to make for a fun, shall we say, movie sermon. And Seacoast has a very large number of folks who tune into Sunday morning worship via the internet, and there's three ways that people tune in. We have a church online website, live.seacoast.org, and the live stream can also be viewed on YouTube and Facebook. Now, YouTube and Facebook are so touchy, and due to the fact that actual movie clips are being shown, Mr. Facebook and Mrs. YouTube boot our stream for copyrights and legal stuff. So this last summer, on YouTube and Facebook, we streamed a video podcast conversation with that weekend's particular speaker to go a bit more in depth while looking at their sermon from different angles. What you hear today are two of those conversations. Pastor Rick talking about the Jesus Revolution and Pastor Josh Surratt looking at Maverick, i.e. Top Gun Part 2. While we're at it, you'll also hear fellow Seacoast staff talk about their favorite movies, and we have a special guest you'll hear from, Paul Brown. He's a local independent theater owner of the Terrace Theater in Charleston. He shares a bit about his relationship with Seacoast and some thoughts on movies in general.
What's up? My name is Micah. I'm the worship leader at the Dream Center campus. I love all things Marvel. I love all things DC Comics. I love Star Wars. I love sci-fi. I love action. I love Christopher Nolan movies. I'm pretty much a movie nerd. I listen to all the soundtracks. I got it saved on my phone like a crazy man, but in all, I just love movies. So if you don't love movies, sad for you.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or as a podcast?
Yeah, just as a person.
No,
person.
I like you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna lead. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about.
Hi, I'm Paul Brown, owner and operator, sometimes operator, of the Terrace Theater. You know, I truly value what Seacoast does in our community and had a working relationship with them for almost 10 plus years. I have personally been affected by some of the people there, and I'd like to consider them as friends, if they'll consider me as friends. I've lived in Charleston for over 13 years, and all that time, owning the Terrace Theater, I'm very fortunate that our theater has become a gathering spot for community events. Joey, the producer of this podcast, wrote this script, so I'm going way off script because it sounds far too braggy and does not really represent my voice. Right, Joey? Theater itself has been voted best theater in Charleston for 8-9 years in a row. It's been voted one of the top 10 attractions in the Carolinas by USA Today. And as I said, we do a lot of work with the community. During COVID, when we were forced to shut down by order, we put in a drive-in for the community. That was a huge success. We also partner with local charities consistently to raise money. Charities such as Low Country Orphan Relief, Darkness to Light, Holocaust Federation, Pet Helpers, and the Food Bank. I remember first meeting Joey and Priscilla, and not really to know what they were like. You know, I hadn't really known a pastor before. Being Jewish, you don't get to meet a lot of pastors unless you're really out there. But when I met them, they wanted to rent the theater for a Christmas Eve service. And I was concerned that they were going to sort of be something they weren't. That concern turned into 9 years of partnership. They were always the best people. We formed lasting bonds with Joey, Priscilla, their family, my wife. The only real reason that this partnership ended was during COVID. It was just too impossible for them to, you know, hold services indoors. So I do have to tell you that I have attended a few services while they had them at the Terrace. I like what Seacoast does on the level, and I like what Joey does. So Joey wanted me to do things that I don't like to do, which includes telling people what my favorite movies are. I never like to do that. It's like asking a songwriter how they write a song, or, you know, so there's so many different things about it. But he told me not to promote the upcoming Exorcist movie that'll be at the theater October 6th, or the Taylor Swift concert series, which begins October 13th for 4 weekends in a row. You know, I've always been involved in movies, and I've always loved it. A little story back is that my great grandparents owned the first movie theater in Toronto where I was born, called the Mary Pickford Theater. And my grandmother was called to the stage to play the piano at age 6 when the regular pianist was away or sick that night. It's silent movies, right? So she grew up playing in the movie theater. And so when we were young kids, we'd always ask grandma to play the damsel tied to the train tracks theme or the burglar in the closet theme and all this stuff from old movies. So I grew up with the movies and the movie business in my blood, I guess. He asked me to say what my favorite decade for movies is and why. Well, maybe it's my age, but I'd say that the 70s and 80s are my favorite decade for movies. The 70s because filmmakers were getting their auteur voice, meaning the Spielberg, Coppola, filmmakers like that were allowed to write and direct the movies, and studios weren't interfering with them and weren't trying to make movies out of video games. 80s because I like John Hughes and those kind of movies. Recently showed my grandchildren Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which they thought was hilarious, and it still holds up. So, again, it's Paul Brown. Thanks for letting me ramble a bit and talk about movies. And more importantly, thank you, Seacoast, for being part of my life.
Hey, I'm Aaron LaFosse, the worship pastor at Seacoast Church in Asheville. And as far as my favorite movie goes, I mean, I love the Rocky films. I'm a sucker for the underdog. But my favorite has to be Amadeus. A bit of a throwback, but I love the drama, the humor. Of course, the soundtrack is amazing. And I love the characters of Mozart and Salieri. In fact, there have been seasons of my life where I can very much relate to Mozart. And there are seasons where I can very much relate to Salieri. And cool little side note, the guy who plays Mozart in Amadeus, Tom Hulce, went to the North Carolina School of the Arts, which is not too far from us here in Asheville. I auditioned for that same school and did not get in. But I'm leading worship now. It all works out fine.
I love movies. This is Pastor T, campus pastor at the North Charleston Dream Center. Growing up before Jesus, my favorite movie was Harlem Nights. It had all the great comedians in it. Red Fox, Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Arsenio Hall. It was a classic, classic movie. Great storyline, just amazing. But now that I'm living my life with Jesus, and I know I probably shouldn't listen to all the bad words, I think my favorite movie currently might be Lion King. And I know that sounds a little crazy because it's really a kiddie movie, but it's got a great story. And I mean, who can forget the moment when Mufasa comes through the sky and says, "Remember whose you are." Like, that's what every person who's ran away from God needs to remember, whose they are.
Hey, Wendy Puttiff here from the Bookstore and Cafe at the Mount Pleasant campus. One of my favorite movies was Safe Haven by Nicholas Sparks. I can't help but fantasize sometimes about running away to some place where no one knows my name and I can start fresh without a bunch of stuff. I love the idea of living in a small town and townspeople all coming together to help people where there's a need. The dreamy love story is kind of great, too.
Awesome. Here with Pastor Greg. Good to see you. Going to talk Jesus Revolution. I just watched it last night. It was awesome.
What do you think?
It was really awesome. Laughing, crying. But before that, let's talk some movies.
Okay.
I got to hear what some of your favorite movies are.
No, you don't want to hear that. I'm just not real deep. You know what I mean? So.
And your list is right here.
Yeah. Probably my two favorite are Rocky III. And Godfather 2.
Gotcha.
You know, when they have the Rocky or Godfather marathons on TV, yeah. I just sit and watch them over and over
yeah.
and over again.
Rocky 3, for a huge Rocky fan as myself and talking to a bunch of Rocky people, it's usually Rocky 1 or Rocky 4 as the favorite Rocky. But yeah, Rocky 3 is unbelievable.
Well, I think I saw that here in Charleston. And people were screaming at the screen. You know, we all knew how it was going to come out, but it was like you were in a real fight.
Yeah. Well, it was a unique Rocky movie, too, because there were two fights.
Yeah.
That was, yeah. And if you could meet Sly or De Niro today,
my goodness.
Have lunch with one of them.
Oh, it would probably be.
I love that you're really thinking about it.
Yeah. It would probably be Sly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, yeah.
The whole Rocky thing.
Oh, it's hard to pass up. And he's done a lot of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Rambo.
Yeah.
All of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you had some Will Ferrell movies.
Oh, gosh.
Is that Is that, and forgive me for saying it this way, is that unique for your age group? Because there's a lot of people that I talk to are a good bit older, and they're like, oh, Will Ferrell, he's dumb.
Oh, I love Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
You know, do I admit that I watched Saturday Night Live?
Yes, you can do that.
I saw the first Saturday Night Live, you know, when it came on, you know, years and years and years ago, and it was John Belushi and one of our local Charleston residents also. But, you know, it's just goofy stuff. I like Talladega Nights and Elf and, you know, all of that. I like, as far as an actor, and I'm showing my age, but Robert Duvall, I liked anything that he would act in. One of his movies was, excuse me, called The Apostle, a little obscure. I don't know, he may have won an Academy Award for that. But it's a story that really is my grandfather. My brother and I went and watched it, and we walked out of the movie and said, oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's my grandfather.
Yeah.
And so anyway. Yeah.
All right, you're going to kill me for this one because I want you to decide Rocky series or Godfather series.
Probably Godfather.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just I like history. And, you know, I've read a lot about, you know, I know there are a lot of stereotypes on mob stuff, but a lot of people say it's pretty, you know, pretty accurate, pretty close to what real story is or was.
What's you and Debbie's go-to?
Oh, romantic comedy.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. If it's not a rom-com, she ain't going. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
And they're fun. They're fun. Any guy that says, oh, I don't like them, there's some insecurities there.
Well, there's some
there,
of them.
Yeah, there's some. But, there's some.
Yeah, but yeah.
Notebook, I think it's a good movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's got a lot of Charleston scenes in it.
and Robbie Madison is in it. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. What if someone told you, I was just thinking about this. In 1988, when you started this church, that there'd be one day where you would be talking online in a podcast studio and people could listen to you on their smartphones.
Yeah.
It'd be like a different language.
Yeah, I think you were speaking in tongues.
Yeah. It's crazy. There is a movie out now on the BlackBerry and archaic it is.
Oh, everybody had it. Yeah,
that, you know you're old when there's a smartphone that is now archaic. I'm like, black.
And BlackBerry ran every... I had the opportunity to go to Washington back when the BlackBerry was the thing, and everybody had one.
Yep.
Everybody had a BlackBerry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so Jesus Revolution. Like I said, I watched it last night, and before we talk about it, I got to say that I can worship to any of the Seacoast worship teams because it's authentic, but my gosh... If the music that's in this movie was, I would never want to stop worshiping. Worshiping. I mean, seriously, it was, and I love how the movie, it translated in the movie. Like, typically powerful music like that, it's hit or miss in a movie, but man, you lived this.
Yeah. And what I would say is this, you know, we do At the Movie series, you know, not every year, but pretty regularly. And sometimes, you know, we do a movie and you go, I don't know if, you know, it's not a great movie, or I don't know if I'd go see it. Everybody should see The Jesus Revolution. Mm-hmm. Everybody. It will, it's moving. Plus, it defines an era, and it tells you a little bit about, if you kind of follow, why we do what we do and how it all came to be. Because you talk about music, when that came out, or during that era, when the music that came out that you said was so good, like we weren't singing that stuff in church, okay? You had songbook with hymns and, you know, that type of thing, and I'm not putting all that down. But as a kid, I was, that movie covers about 1971, 72. The movie is basically... during that era, maybe 73 a little bit. And I'm 16 years old, you know, 17 years old. And music is a big, big deal.
Yeah.
And there just aren't any options Christian-wise. So, yeah, it was an amazing time, amazing season.
So this literally was an before that sort of music, there really wasn't relevant Christian music to a younger age. I mean, because since then, there always has been. There's always been bands that youngsters can listen to and be like, oh, man, this is pretty good stuff. But before the Jesus movement, it probably wasn't.
Well, you've got, you know, rock and roll, the King, you know, 1956, Elvis breaks onto the scene, and that's when I was born. And then it evolves into the Beatles. And in the early 60s, and then you've got the psychedelic rock and roll music. And that was like, you know, church world was here, and that was way over here.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, I know my parents tried to keep me from listening to any of that.
Right.
And so, yeah, it wasn't in the church. That wasn't an option.
Yeah. So having not existed to see all of this and feel it firsthand, was it a stretch in the movie just how hippie these Christians were? I mean, just like, man, it's just the love of Jesus. And they weren't high because they had turned from drugs to Jesus. But was it a stretch, or that's how you guys really were?
Well,
there was even a line where they're like, this drummer's not going to be back for a few weeks. He's got to finish his time for drug. And like, it happens.
Oh, yeah. They're without a doubt. But what you have to understand, the traditional church didn't see these people as Christians right away, because there was the 60s and early 70s was the drugs, sex, rock and roll. It was a revolution. This movie says Jesus revolution. Well, it was in the midst of a major crazy time,
right,
in America. That
was, for the youth mainly.
Oh yeah. You know, you had political turmoil. You had a war. Vietnam that was extremely unpopular.
A bunch of assassinated guys.
Assassinations in the 60s. It was just a crazy time. Protests about the war mainly. And then his music is the defining thing of all of that. And so a lot of that music was those people that outside of the church. You know, we did this in the church and they did that out there. And in fact, Larry Norman, one of the earliest pioneers of Christian music, right during that same time as the Jesus Revolution, had a song called Don't Let the Devil Have All the Good Music. And that was kind of it. And his premise was radical at the time, is that God created music. Yeah. Let's not relegate this as unchristian, or we can't use this kind of music. And so that's kind of the thought pattern of the time. Yeah.
So as massive as that movement was, the hippie generation, whatever you call it, did the actual Jesus movement, what we're talking about right now, did it get the nation's attention in the midst of all that? So it was a big deal that people talked about. I mean, in the movie, it really did seem like, you know, you tune into the news at night and you may hear about these Jesus people.
I don't know if it was that. If it was, you know, every night on the news, but it was, and I think the movie defines it well, it was a group of people who were looking for something, okay? And they were looking in sex, they were looking in, you know, that's the sexual revolution, they were looking in Eastern religions, mm-hmm. they were looking in at drugs, and, you know, music and all of that. And the Jesus Revolution was just people who were doing that and not finding what they were looking for. And they found it in Jesus, but they liked the music and the vibe and the whole hippie thing. Mm-hmm. Did you see it on TV? The first time I remember really catching the nation's attention was when the Lonnie Frisbee, and we didn't know who Lonnie Frisbee was, but at least I didn't. I knew there was this hippie guy that was at the middle of the one that I knew was Chuck Smith. I knew I had heard his name. But when they put the Time magazine, I think, the cover, and I think they used that for the video, you began to see a little bit. And then it was the ocean baptisms, where you had hundreds or thousands of people who were there at Pirate's Cove, And when that was on the front of one of the magazines of the time, it really became a big deal. And then when Billy Graham got involved, and at Expo 72, which is depicted in the movie, when Billy Graham actually put his stamp on the music, and we were there. I was in Dallas in 72. And when Billy Graham put his stamp on the music and said, the music's okay, that's when more, not all, but more churches started to be open to this new music for a new generation.
Yeah. Golly. That, yeah. Billy, and they depict that actually on the movie with Billy Graham and everything. So that was a big time turning point.
Well, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of people in Dallas at
the
time.
Right.
I happened to have a band at that time. So it was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
And, yeah. So. When you think about, well, I tell you what, I want to hear a couple of stories. We're talking about this beforehand, and you just told me that Amy Grant opened for your band.
Yeah.
That is something else.
Well,
and you recognize something special because she obviously was a very talented
songwriter.
Yeah,
when I say open, that's probably loose. What the deal was, if you watch, there's another video I would recommend. I was recommending to you before we began to talk. And that's the Jesus Music. And that was a documentary that came out a couple of years ago. And it traces the Jesus Music from this time all the way till now. And there was an amusement park in Denver called Elitch's. Now it's Six Flags over Denver, Elitch's or whatever. And anyway, they had their first Christian night, early 70s. And we were a local band, had a little notoriety locally. And so we played, and there was this 15-year-old girl with a guitar that came up, and she was going to share the stage, you know, and who's this? We were pretty arrogant. You know? And I can't predict. I couldn't have predicted, wow, this she's going to be as big as she was, but I could tell she's got some chops.
Yeah. So you were already a Christian at the time, and you said 16 in the
Yeah, peak of this. It's
because I'm curious how the Jesus movement affected your faith.
Right. Well, I grew up in the church. And so in the church I grew up in, you could lose your salvation pretty quickly too. So
that's what the altar calls were for.
Yeah, and same people every week. But yeah, so I was in and out of really I would say I was never a non-Christian, but I followed Jesus, but followed him from a distance, okay? And the Jesus people, the music of the Jesus revolution, I don't know that they called it that then, but whatever was going on showed me that these were heroes for me and showed me that people could follow Jesus and still, you know, because we had a real strong separation, you know, be ye separate,
right.
You know, and we had that, although my dad was more open than most to this, but so I had a band. We played in churches, we played in coffee houses, we played anywhere we could, and we actually got kicked out of a couple of churches, including Debbie's home church, which is one of the biggest churches in Denver, and they did a big Jesus night with a speaker, and they wanted to get a lot. They probably had 800 kids that came, and they wanted us to play the opening set and then a speaker, and then we play a later set. And so we just opened with what we played, which wasn't your average church music. And after the first set, one of the deacons came and said, "You won't be playing at the end."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you talk about in your, and the actual message that people will hear on, I don't know how to say this, we'll cut this, but in the message that people are going to listen to in the actual physical locations, just how impactful the Jesus revolution music wise was on Seacoast.
Oh yeah. It's, when I saw and experienced the music, which at first was, and if you listen to early, some of the early Randy Stonehill or, and I mentioned him a minute ago, I can't remember whatever, yeah. But you listen to some of the early music. It was like secular, if you want to call it that, music, in that it was a song with a message, and you know, you don't sing along with until you really learn the words and you're in right. concert and sing. It morphed from that to love song, which was worship. And it was worship with the words and the feelings of the kids of the generation. And that was radical to me, absolutely radical. And I got hooked at that point. And
because it was really, really good music.
Oh, it was good music.
Because a lot of times Christian music gets a bad rap, and sometimes for good reasons. Yeah. But I mean, the music on this movie, I'm like, I could listen to this all day.
Oh, and there was so much of it at the time that was like that. And I remember walking through a cornfield in Illinois thinking, you know, and maybe this was prophetic, but thinking, it doesn't matter whether you're a Baptist or a Methodist or Assemblies of God like I was, this music could be sung everywhere.
Yeah.
And might be the thing that brings the church together.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we could say the church is together now, but we basically all sing the same music.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe we need some more hippies right now.
There you go. It's not going to be you and I. We don't have any hair.
Right.
I'd be a hippie if I could be. But.
So everyone is searching for something, and that something is Jesus. That's yes. something that you talk about a lot. As you get older, do you become more convinced of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And why? Because I also hear people say, hey, the more I learn about God, the more I understand there's so much more there is to know. And I don't know if they're alluding to doubt or what, but why does your faith in that truth become stronger with time?
Well, even in today, kind of a popular, becoming popular deal is the deconstruction, right. You know, the whole deconstruction thing. And I get that. I've deconstructed my faith, you know, from, and what I say is from what I, maybe some things that I believed even back during the era that this movie ran, there were some things that I believed then that I really don't believe now. The thing that solidified my following Jesus in about 1974-75, when I was about 18, 19 years old, again, always raised in church, but the thing that solidified it for me was a search for what is truth. Mm-hmm. You know, you had Eastern religion, the Beatles are doing all their stuff in India and all of that. And I'm going, okay, what really is truth? And I came at that point in my life to two basic foundations that are still the same today. Number one, there is a God. Did he create the world in 6 days or 7 days or seven eras, or was there a big bang or all of that? You know, I've got ideas about that, right. But so do you, and right. It doesn't really matter. The truth is there is a God behind all of it. And it takes a whole lot more faith for me to not believe that.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Than it does to believe that. Okay, we can argue about all the other stuff, and, you know, it really doesn't bother me that much. And the second reality is that—
Can I guess?
Jesus Christ
rose from the dead.
Rose from the dead.
Right here. Those are the two. That's what I fall on.
Everything else is fun. Some is helpful. Some is not. But those two things are the things that I said, okay, I'm going to give my life to this back then, and it's the same today for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, and you probably didn't realize just how big it was at that moment in my faith journey, but I was in Montana with you. It was just the two of us on a boat with the guy that was helping us fly fish. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was your exact words, but you said something along the lines of doctrine has its place in conversation, but at Seacoast, I think you said we peddle community.
Mm-hmm.
And that really came out in this movie when people talked about God moving amongst them. It was amongst them. That was a big part of it.
That was a big deal of the movie. Yeah, it really was. And it was so interesting because Chuck Smith in the movie is this pastor, small church, and having a real hard time getting his hands, his arms around the whole hippie thing, and which it, listen, everybody did. Okay, everybody did. It wasn't just Chuck Smith. It was a countercultural movement that wasn't all roses and all of that.
And even the Christian version was counterculture.
Oh, it definitely was. And the Christian version was messy. Okay, it wasn't like they came. Lonnie Frisbee is an example of that. He's one of the heroes of this story, but he was very messy. And the movie kind of touches on that a little bit at the end, but it was very, very messy and hard to, okay, you can't put it in this box or that box or whatever. But what you could do is experience the love of Jesus. That was just obvious.
Yeah.
And without denial.
Yeah. So it's something that is talked about a lot, and I get a lot of the sentiments as far as this generation and what technology is doing to this generation and dropping out of the church and all of that. There feels like a helplessness, hopelessness in that conversation when we reflect on youth today. You are seeing that, hearing that, and you also lived through the 70s, and I know you're a lot younger then, but do you see any similarities in how we're reflecting on the youth today than we were in the 70s?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, it gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. We say the times are crazy now. I don't think they're as crazy as they were
then.
I can't imagine how my parents felt about all that was going on around them at the time. I mean, I could, from a kid's point of view, I could kind of get it a little bit, but it was crazy. And and what happened?
Yeah.
There was Jesus in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And I think there's Jesus in the middle of everything that's going on now, because it's the same thing. It's a search for what is real, what is reality, what is meaning. And honestly, there are good things everywhere. God created, you know, the earth, and there's good things in everywhere if you look for them. But at the focus of, if your focus is on reality, meaning, purpose, all of that, it's going to be a little bit of an empty search until you come to Jesus.
Right.
And
Jesus seems to lend out that if you seek the truth, then you're going to find me.
It. Yeah. And and I would say this, I know it's hard for parents. It's tough. It's difficult. But sometimes we kind of get this idea that, you know, if our kids go over here that, you know, they're going to find all this wonderful. You know what? Over time, it doesn't live well. Apart from Jesus, I would postulate that ultimately it doesn't live well. And God is more concerned about the kids of this generation than I am or you are or their parents are. And I think that at the end of it is a search for him.
Yeah.
And like you said, he says, if you seek me, you'll find me. And sometimes we don't even know that's who we're seeking.
Right. Wrapping this thing up, but I did have a question about Lenny. The movie did a good job doing this, and I'm wondering if this was intended. I had mixed emotions about Lenny because he seemed to be extremely genuine, extremely caring, but then it did start becoming about him. Did he leave his church family because he wasn't the center of attention anymore? Was it that bad?
I don't know if that's what, I don't know.
Right.
I know he struggled with a lot of things. He was used by God so powerfully on Sunday mornings and with these kids, and he had a gift that was amazing. But he also struggled with sin in his life, and he left the Calvary Chapel movement. Actually, was a part of starting the Vineyard movement, which was another big movement of the time. Left there, became involved in the discipleship movement in Florida, and ultimately died a fairly young man. And he had a lot of struggles. But here's what I know is I know God loved him, and I know that God uses flawed individuals. We want all our heroes to be perfect. And you know what? I don't want to excuse sin in any way, because what sin does is it messes up families, it messes up individuals, it messes up just a lot of stuff, okay? That's why I want to grow more and more like Jesus every day, and, you know, I get all of that. But I also, I'm worried today that even in our cancel culture, that we want our heroes to be perfect. And guess what? None of them are.
Right.
None of them are. You know, I was thinking about in the movie, one, another big thing that influenced me were the baptisms. I actually lived out there. I went to the concerts in that big white tent that you see in the movies. And I never went to a baptism, but I heard about them and I read about them. And when we started Seacoast Church, it was a no-brainer for me. I looked at the ocean and saw how close that we are and said, we're going to do ocean baptism. Yeah. And we've had literally thousands of people over the years be baptized in the ocean. But there's a beautiful thing about baptism, and it's symbolic of just the God doing more than we can do. It's washing the sin. You know, people like Lonnie Frisbee struggled with sin. God is his judge. I'm going to let that be the case. But it's amazing what God can do through flawed human beings, and he still does.
Yeah. Speaking of flawed human beings, I know you and I would consider us in that category.
Well, you are. I know that.
How about I'm more flawed?
No, we're about the same.
How confident are you? And maybe that's a tough word. I wouldn't want someone to ask me how confident. But when you stand before Jesus and you're looking into those eyes of love and you recognize that everything you ever wanted is standing in front of you, will he say, well done, my good and faithful servant, when it comes to Seacoast keeping Jesus the main thing?
You know, I mean, that would put me in Jesus' position. That's a little bit humbling. But I'll answer it like this. Yep. I don't think God's disappointed in me. I think God radically, radically loves me. I think he radically, radically loves you. So I don't think there's going to be any disappointment in when I stand before the Lord. I think that, he loves us.
Yeah. That's a very profound answer, that life is about being loved by God and not as much as what we're doing. It's who we are in God,
yeah.
Not what we're doing.
Yeah, and that's...
Man, that's big.
Who we are, yeah.
That's big. Pastor Greg, it's been awesome.
Thank you.
Been awesome.
Been
Thank
fun.
You.
Yep. Thank you.
All right, two things I look for in movies. Number one thing is how they tell the story. It has to be compelling, has to draw me in. The characters have to be believable, and yet at the very end, when you don't think it's going to work out, it does. The best movie for the story is Shawshank Redemption, 100% hands down. No competition there. Andy Dufresne walking into Shawshank prison. Relationship with Red coming out free the other side. Both of them at the end of the story. There's nothing better than Shawshank for a good story. Second is humor. Dry humor. Best in Show, Waiting for Guffman. These are movies you're looking at, staring at, and you're like, is this really happening? And you're laughing so stinking hard.
My name is Brianna McLeod, and I'm the director of SCU Seacoast. Ever since I was a little girl, my favorite movie of all time has been The Sound of Music. From singing nuns and the beautiful landscapes of Austria to a strong-willed female lead falling in love with a handsome captain and his seven children, I'll never forget the impact this movie made on my life as a child and the way it taught me the power of music and its ability to heal the broken and hurting and bring people together.
Hey, this is Adam Erickson, one of the filmmakers here at Seacoast. And as a filmmaker, you're probably thinking, oh, his favorite movie? It's got to be something like Citizen Kane or The Godfather. And both of those movies are great. I love them both. I'd watch them any day. But what's my favorite movie? Mission Impossible 2. That's right, the objectively worst movie in the Mission Impossible series. Directed by John Woo, it's filled with every moment that John Woo has ever put into his films, dialed up to 10. And I love every minute of it.
What's up, man?
Hey, how are you?
Good to see you.
You too.
Were you a fan of Top Gun back in the day, like the original one?
I don't think I saw it until maybe 10 years after it came out.
Were you not allowed to?
Probably not.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed to.
I had pretty strict parents.
Yeah, me too.
There was all kinds of language and...
Yeah, so I actually saw it to prepare for Maverick because I had never seen it.
Oh, wow.
And people would ask, like Top Gun would come up and that was like my big reveal. I've never seen it. What? You've never seen Top Gun? Oh my gosh. I didn't really think it was that great, but I had people tell me if you would have seen it in the 80s, you would have been blown away.
Yeah,
and
I'm sure.
That makes complete sense.
I saw it in the early 2000s and I was not overwhelmed with it either.
Right. But I will say the Take My Breath Away song was way too much. There were times when I was like, that had to have been a mistake. There's no way that song should have come up. I mean, it really was hilarious. I was like, how many times?
But,
boom, 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 boom.
But aren't the 80s known for just too much?
Wasn't
that basically how you would describe it?
Too much, yeah. Too much. What are some of your favorite movies?
The Left Behind series. I'm joking. It's not. But I did meet Kirk Cameron.
Nice.
Last year for the first
last
time.
Last year.
Very, very good guy. Kind and fun. And I didn't know it was Kirk Cameron until I was done with the conversation. My buddy was like, hey, have you met Kirk? And I was like, no. And so I'm like, hey, Kirk, I'm Josh. What do you do? And he's just super kind. And then we talked for about 5 minutes and he walks away. And I was like, wait a minute, was that Kirk Cameron? And he goes, yeah. So anyways, no, but I am like, I'm a sucker for inspiration.
Yeah.
And so I love sports movies. I love Rocky, the entire series, Creed, even the more recent ones.
Yeah.
Like if I can just like get caught up in a sports story and cheer for the underdog, I'm going to love it. I love Denzel Washington movies like back in the day, Remember the Titans.
Oh, yeah.
And I just think he's a phenomenal, like even the ones that I went back at, some of them you go back and rewatch, like you're talking about Top Gun. I went back and rewatched John Q.
Oh yeah.
And,
that's a fun movie.
I mean, I thought it was one of my best favorite movies ever in the theater, but when you watch it now on TNT, it's not quite the same.
Right.
It's like, you know,
right.
It's like when I had my kids watch Napoleon Dynamite and I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And they're looking at me like, Dad, are you serious?
Really?
There's
my kids liked
fun
it.
About it. Well, some of them were okay with some scenes, but it's yeah. They didn't get some of the, I think, the humor of the day passed them over
right.
just a little
yeah.
bit. But I mean, and I'll also go at the risk of losing many church members here, Talladega Nights. I mean, I still just think there's nothing like Will Ferrell and Shake and Bake, and you know what do I do with my like? I loved it. You know, I want to laugh.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah, Will Ferrell will do it.
He will do it.
Is he one of your favorite actors?
He definitely was.
Who are some other low hanging fruit?
Well, like
you gotta say
I mentioned
Sly.
Denzel, but I definitely love Sylvester Stallone. But I feel like for me, Chris Farley, Adam Sandler, Will Ferrell. Like I was a child of the 90s.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I just loved anything they put out. I was going to watch.
Yeah.
In fact, I recommended at Thanksgiving when my cousins at the time were probably all like 6 to 10. And we always go see a movie at Thanksgiving, or we used to back in the day. And so they asked for a recommendation and I said Waterboy.
Yeah.
And I had seen it before. So then we go with like my aunts and uncles, very conservative young children.
Right.
And like it was two or three scenes in that they were like, what have you done?
So. People cannot like relate to what you and I experience at this phase of movie watching. I remember there was so much built up of Adam Sandler after Happy Gilmore. I was in the theater to see Wedding Singer because that was the movie that came out afterward. When it started, the theater clapped.
Oh, yeah.
We were like, yeah! I mean, we cheered
well,
the beginning of a movie.
You would see the trailer for that movie
right.
6-8 months right. earlier at another movie, and then there was no streaming. You were just waiting
exactly.
for that thing to come out.
Exactly. Why did you pick Top Gun or Maverick for at the movies?
Well, first of all, Tom Cruise and I are very similar in the way we look, and so I often get confused. You know, no, I, you know, so I watched that one in the theater, and I think one of the things that struck me really early on was this tension that you saw with Maverick of trying to figure out how do I fit in
now.
It's almost like a basketball legend or sports legend that's now at retirement, and all of their identity was wrapped up in, you know, themselves as a athlete or as a at whatever it is. And you saw this with Tom Cruise, that he was trying to figure out, who am I in this ever-changing world? And I talk about that a lot in this movie, is that the world changes so much, and he's this fighter pilot, and he's so gifted. And you see him now, what, 20, 30 years later, and he's 50 years old, and he's still doing the same thing. Most of the guys that are 50 years old are now admirals, or, you know, they're high ups. They've got this, and he has not adapted at all. Yeah. He's still got this identity. And it made me think about the tension that we have with identity, calling, and assignment. And so give me just a second to riff on that. I didn't even go there when I recorded this film, but I think it's really important. On average, like, my grandfather was in the same career for 55 years, same job, worked for Frontier Airlines, had the same lunchbox, all of this stuff. And that used to be the norm. You had a job, and that really was kind of your identity. Well, now, on average, people change jobs. I think it's like 26 times. Gosh. That the average person who's 18 right now, he'll have 26 jobs, or she'll have 26 jobs in their career. And so if your identity comes in your job, yeah, well, think about how many identity crises that is.
Oh my God.
If that's where we wrap it up in. And so I think that you see that with Maverick. You know, he is a fighter pilot. That's who he is. He's this edgy young guy, even though now he's in his 50s.
Right.
And he's trying to adapt to learn how to be a trainer and a teacher of them. And so your assignment changes all the time. And then we have a calling, which I would say, like, for Joey Svensson, you have a gift with people. There are things that you're good at that that may come natural to you, that I could try all my life to get good at and never get as good at you with engaging, asking questions, the way that you relate. And so you've been a campus pastor. You've been in a band. Now you're leading a podcast. You've had a lot of different assignments in your life, but who Joey is and what you're good at, I would say that's kind of in the realm of your calling. It's like these guardrails of things that you know that you were put on this planet to do. And I'm hitting on like a couple that I see. There are more than that. And then we have...
Oh, there's more good things that you like about me?
I couldn't name any. I named all that I know, but other people have said good things over the years. But then you have your identity. And so your identity is a thing that really never changes. And so for us as Christ followers, it would be like, man, my identity is in Christ and as a son of God, and my identity as a dad, right? That's a pretty permanent assignment that I have on this side of eternity. And so there are some things that I take my identity from. And I think when we take our identity from something that's going to change 26 times in our, you know, working years, that's part of why we probably have so many people struggling with identity crises and who am I and what am I? And so it struck me watching this film that, man, this guy is trying to figure out, who am I now? That this season of my life is past, and I was this young rock star pilot. Yeah. So
it is crazy. Like, that is typically the second question you're asked if you're meeting a new person. It's like, what's your name? And what do you do?
What do you do? And what they're asking is, who are you?
Right.
So, I mean, that's how we receive it. And so, and I don't know. I mean, I've had a pretty stable career in terms of different roles, but working at Seacoast, and it probably wasn't until Lisa, my wife, who as a PA by training, and she'd worked in the ER for a long time, and then she was fighting human trafficking, and then she stayed at home for about a year. And I remember her really wrestling with, like, man, when I meet people and I can tell them I fight human trafficking, that feels different.
Right.
And, well, I'm staying home right now. And she wrestled through, like, well, who am I really, like, apart from the roles that I've had? And I've never had to really, you know, ask the question or wrestle deeply with, who is Josh apart from Seacoast or pastor? I'd like to think that there's more to me than that, and that my identity is deeper than that. But I can't imagine how hard that is for people to process.
Yeah. So I was looking through your notes, and there's some good therapy stuff. Like, I kind of see, like, mental health stuff, and I'm just going to read what you, like, 3 points. It says, some things will change whether I want them to or not. Some things never change, even if I want them to. Some things can change, but it's up to me. I mean, these are this is like the power of acceptance.
Right.
My therapist actually told me one time, because I was talking about, you know, somebody's doing this or that. She's just like, Joey, people never do what you want them to do. So what are you going to do with that?
Right.
But what was the tie-in with the movie? I've only seen it once and it's been a while.
Well, just the fact that that the world had changed in 30, you know, you still see him trying to figure out, like, who am I in this ever-changing world? And they want him to become an instructor, right? And he's, like, trying to adapt to this thing. And for me, it just was a reminder of, I know we like to think that our generation is unique and every, yeah, but like really the world has never changed at the pace that it's changed in you and I's lifetime. I mean, when we were born in the 70s, you know, we were the remote control for the TV, the big box TV that sat, that you had one in a family and we all watched the same screen. And that's why you had these shows that were, you know, and now everybody has their own screen and obviously AI, just the world is changing so fast. And so it can be unsettling to try to figure out, like, well, what doesn't change and what's my role in it? And so I don't know if that's just because of our changing world that seeing that movie made me think, you know, gosh, he's having to figure out how to adapt and how do I stay true to the core values of who I am, what things shouldn't change. And that's where connecting it to a God. And I love the passage that said he's the same, you know, yesterday, today, and forever, that we have something that we can anchor ourselves in the midst of all of the change. And that's the character, the unchanging nature and character of God. And then hopefully try to discern, like, is this change something I can be a part of? Or is this change something I should stay away from?
Yeah. Yeah. What does it look like to lend an ear to when our values, because you and I, as Christians, our values correlate with our faith. So what does it look like for our ears to be open to maybe sometimes our values not being accurate? So, you know, some, these are extreme examples, but you have in church history, genocide. We thought we were doing that in the name of God. Then you have slavery. We pointed to scriptures and basically justified that, I think, more recently. And I know this is still kind of on the table of church debate, but Rick Warren came forward and apologized to women in how Saddleback was structured for not really accommodating women to grow in leadership. You know, it's just like he would say, man, my values were kind of off 20 years ago. And so, I mean,
well, and what I see in Rick, and not to get off on that, is just a sense of theological humility. And I think we tend to become very prideful about our theology. And again, I do think that it's important to stand firm in your faith and the core values of what that is. But I think that we forget that the word disciple, it literally translates to a learner. And what they would do is, I mean, back in the day of like first century Israel, you've been to Israel, but they would, like, part of what it meant to be a rabbi and to follow a rabbi is to look at the same text and constantly reread it and try to look at it from a different angle and try to, you know, study it from a different perspective. And so inherent in our faith was that we are trying to learn and grow and right. understand. And I think what happens for a lot of us is that we will grow up maybe with a set of values that were taught to us by our parents, good or bad, and then we'll build a value system around that, and then we'll try to find scripture to justify our current value system. And I think that's where people get off. And it's hard to know how would I have handled it if I lived in the days of the church and genocide. But you would hope that we would go, hey, let's constantly be studying the word and changing and learning more about what it is. I know for you and I going to Israel, just understanding a little bit about a first century Jewish context goes, wow, some things don't mean what I thought they meant.
Right.
And I have to have humility before God to go, okay, I might have been wrong about that. I want to be the one who's adapting to your unchanging word, not vice versa.
Sure.
And I think we're all going to be tempted at times to find scripture that will justify whatever it is that we believe strongly or hold strongly. And I just think we're in a danger zone when we're doing that.
Yeah.
Because you could put any topic on the table, and we could take a scripture out of context and probably find a way to justify
it. Oh, yeah. So. Oh, yeah. With all the change from one generation to the next, you even referred to how quickly it's happening. But with your dad passing the baton of leadership to you, was it partly motivated by Pastor Greg kind of recognizing, well, my son is going to be more in touch with his generation. Tim Keller, I'm pretty sure when he passed away, he was still the main guy at Redeemer, right?
I think so. Yeah. But yeah, what Dad started doing, though, is early on, he would do a message planning meeting. And part of the reason he did it is because he wanted to pull a bunch of people into the room. He was a middle-aged white man, married man with four kids. So he would bring women into the room, and he'd bring single people into the room. He'd bring younger people into the room. And yep. I think it started with a series he was doing on finances. And he was like, hey, brought a bunch of college kids in the room. I was like, here's what I'm talking about, and here's where I'm going.
But yeah.
What are college kids talking about with finances? I have no idea. And so that was back when, like, bling, and you know, there were certain even just phrases that he was like, I want to learn in that. And so what I've seen him do well, that I have seen very few people as they age do well, is stay open to and ask for the opinions of the next generation. And so I don't think it ever started as like, well, he's more in touch with the next generation. But I do think that as we did that, what he did unknowingly is he taught us as the next generation how to write a message and how to go to God for a word. And, you know, he wanted stuff from us, but we were actually learning and being discipled on how to do it. And it made for a pretty seamless transition to the next generation. And we don't really see that happen a lot, especially in the church. But any organization trying to go from a first generation to a second generation, there's a massive fall off in how successful it is. And I would say when people talk about Seacoast, and we have pastors all around the country that will come into the retreat or will be asked to be part of podcasts, and they'll ask, well, how has it been so successful? And my answer in all reality is probably 85% him.
Yeah.
Because he was willing to let go before all the young people had left the church. He was willing to, you know, because I didn't feel ready at all. When he said, hey, it's time, I was 34. I was like, what is wrong with you? It is not time. But in doing that, it forced us to grow and step in. And
so he's the Tom Cruise of the Maverick movie.
He is the Tom Cruise. Yeah.
All right.
And
when I watch Mission Impossible, I'm going to try to visualize your dad.
What does that make me then? What's Goose's son? Rooster. That makes me Rooster.
You're Rooster.
I'm growing the mustache.
All right.
I'm just going to,
Real quick, I want to get personal with you. Do you feel pretty sure that you're where God wants you when it comes to your specific role here at Seacoast?
My assignment?
Yeah.
Right now?
Yeah.
This second, I feel pretty sure about it.
Yeah. Do you ever doubt
it? In an hour, maybe not.
Right.
And
you're being serious. There's times when you
doubt. I struggle with that, for
sure. What do you do when you doubt?
Usually, I just keep going. You know, I really more so early on. So probably the first two or three years of doing this, the only real models that I had seen of people leading large churches like Seacoast, like the mega church, if you will, I only saw examples of guys that looked very different than me, and I feel like are gifted differently than me, that were just these rock star preachers and really dynamic, you know, communicators, and they would do 80, 90% of the time. And so I think what began as a lot of self-doubt, I don't know that I'm called to do this. I think y'all are making a mistake, but I'm willing to give it a shot. I think I've learned in hindsight that maybe some of the reluctance that I had as a leader that may present as humility, and sometimes it is, and sometimes it's just insecurity, I think was a strength more than it was a weakness. I think in hindsight, the church didn't need some young, arrogant dude that thought he was the best thing that, you know, the church actually needed to adapt. And now we've got this teaching team model, and now we're, you know, have a little bit more of a collaborative approach. And so I have a hard time pinpointing, is that just really good leadership by me? Or is that insecurity that kind of helped us find this? Or is it some kind of a mixed bag? Because I do, I mean, like everybody, I have doubts about whether I'm doing the right thing and whether I'm doing a good job at what I'm doing, whether that's my parenting, whether that's as a husband. I think that if we present this idea that you should never question that stuff, then we just fake it. And there are times that we need to fake it. We need to just keep moving. But I've always had people to process it with. And, you know, it's interesting, that question. My dad, when he initially transitioned the church to me and to our team, it came out of him questioning, I'm not dreaming about Seacoast. I don't have a lot of vision for Seacoast right now. And I think something's wrong with me. And he processed with the counselor. It was Chip Judd who helped him to see, actually, there's not something wrong with you. This is transition. And so that what may have felt like doubt and something's wrong was actually like maybe nudging of God transition. And he had, I'm sure, had gone into many other years without a ton of vision, but knew it's like, all right, we got to pray. We got to work through it. We got to, you know, fake it if we need to. But this time it was actually that doubt that helped him see maybe it's time to move on to something next.
All right. So Josh, people can change, like people will see in Maverick. And sometimes change starts with recognizing, hey, life is not just about me. Because in the movie, I mean, it was kind of a matter of survival for him to change.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise's character. And I really like how you laid this out, is that you can change in two different ways. One, how you see yourself, and then two, how you see your circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unpack that for
unpack
us.
Unpack it. Yeah, I'll unpack it for you. I think for me, it probably starts with seeing yourself.
Yeah.
And so anytime something happens to me or there's a situation that caught me by surprise, I feel like there's the incident that happens, but then there's what I tell myself about that incident. And so I think reminding myself of the truth is huge. Of the,
you may have missed your calling, by the way. You'd make a good therapist.
Maybe I'll do it. Hey. But you know, like
seriously, that's good stuff, man.
I feel like, and the way I would say it in my Christianese terms is like, okay, the enemy stole from you in this moment, but don't let him steal from you for the rest of your life.
Right.
Like there's ways that like how we process it and believe about ourselves is important. And so we are more than overcomers. And I do believe that God works all things together for the good of those who are in Christ and called according to his purposes. And so reminding myself of who I am in Christ is huge, but then also going, okay, like in the parts of those things, like remember, some things never change, and that's good. Some things are changing and I have no control over it, whether I want them to or not. Some things are going to change, but I'm going to be involved. And that's going, hey, like I actually have an opportunity to bring the kingdom of heaven into this situation, to bring my attitude that reflects Christ, and to bring solutions that maybe reflect Christ, and that I can then be a part of changing them. Because I'm thinking about, I told you earlier, and I won't name any names, but we got somebody who was going on a mission trip that lost their passport between their first stop and the trip overseas. And so they're not at home, and mom's now going to pick them up. And it's like, we were having this conversation. It's like, this stinks. Like, I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it or whatever. But what if God already knew this was going to happen? And what if there's something beautiful that's going to come out of it, and the ride home,
right,
and a window that you're going to get into the heart of this person? And you know, like, so if I have an attitude about my circumstances that, okay, it's not a surprise to God. He's already at work on a solution, to quote, you know, Greg Surratt, my dad, he says that all the time. So how can I look at my situation a little bit differently? And, you know, when we talk about, we've talked about this a lot and we've heard people share, but when you pray, you know, sometimes we experience healing like we talked about a few months ago with our healing services, but sometimes it's me that changes in the process.
Yeah.
And being open to that being maybe God's answer to prayer.
And I even think that sometimes changing the circumstances is changing the value that we're putting on certain things, because a person could be upset that they're not making a certain level of income. Well, let's get deeper then. What is money to you? Is that what brings you contentment? Is that what makes you happy? Because those are like roots that need to change.
Oh, yeah. Well, and when we've had downturns in the economy, you know, we pray for a lot of people, and of course, people struggle financially. And there are times where the prayer request is that God would, you know, turn my financial situation around. And there's a part of me that wonders at times, is that God's best? You know, and again, not to be callous about it, but sometimes when money has too much of a grip on us, or we've got a wrong attitude about it, maybe the most loving thing that a God would do is allow us to be freed from that for a moment, to get a different perspective about our circumstances.
Totally.
And so that's certainly been the case in my life.
Totally. Well, we'll wrap this up here. You, Josh Surratt, you're on mission at Seacoast. You also, the general calling that we're talking about, what does it mean, and what should it mean to all of us that God is with us? I mean, that sounds like such a basic question, but I think it's profound.
Well, it is, and it's fun in the sense of this movie, right? Because in the movie, you've got Tom Cruise, Maverick, becomes this trainer teacher, and he's doing all he can do to tell them how to fly this mission and what it's going to take and to do it. But at the end of the day, the thing that turned the tide of their ability to accomplish it was when he actually got in with them and flew it. And I think for me, it's just a helpful reminder that, man, God did not go, all right, I created this thing. I'm going to put some human beings out there and y'all go accomplish really hard, impossible things and make it happen and let me know how it went.
Yeah.
And I think about, I had told this story a while back, but I was, my son was running sprints and I felt like I was supposed to run them with him and I did for part of them. Then he outlasted me, but it's like something about knowing that, man, when I lose somebody that I love, when I go through the job loss or the tough stuff of life that are going to happen because it's earth and it's not heaven. When I walk through that, knowing that I'm not walking through it alone, that I have a God who didn't just say, go figure it out, but said, man, I will be near to the brokenhearted. Yeah. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. And, you know, we grow up and we get callous and we have all these experiences, but so many times when my kids were little, and I still have one that will do it, when there's a storm outside, she'll come into my room at night. And my logical brain will go, there is nothing different about her chances of getting struck by lightning in her room or in my room. But there's something about being with her dad that brings comfort, that brings a sense of security. And I don't think we're ever supposed to grow out of that.
Yeah, I love that, man. You're pulling on my parent heartstrings. Come on. Now going to make me cry.
Hey, I'm Ross White, campus pastor at our Greenville campus, and I'd have to say the James Bond movies have to top it for me. I mean, and Daniel Craig in particular, I think. I don't know how they're ever going to top his role as Bond. But, I mean, there's just something about good overcoming evil against all odds. Like, that's just like the meta-narrative that just speaks to my soul.
My name is Brian Adelman. I'm the campus pastor of the Irmo campus, and my favorite movie of all time is Back to the Future. I love the entire trilogy for many reasons. It's funny, it's entertaining, it's got great music, and I believe best time travel trilogy of all time. It also is nostalgic with me and my family, and now I get to watch it with my son, and he's understanding it, going, that's what time travel is, and now he shouts, those things don't work on water unless they have power. Back to the Future, all the way, all day. I could watch it at any moment. I could quote it every second of the day. Favorite movie of all time.
Thanks for listening. There's a link in the show notes to our podcast Facebook page where we talk about these episodes and share some behind-the-scenes information, including guests we're booking. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Hey, it's Desiree Clement, administrator at our West Campus. I absolutely love the movie Elf. Like Die Hard, some people only like to watch it around Christmas time, but I can watch it any time of year. Betty's character is so lovable. He hugs, sings, eats tons of junk food, and throws a mean curveball. He loves to smile, and smiling's my favorite.